From the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Ben Ponce, and this is On Target.
I'm Gari Mangala, and today on Target, we will be discussing the recent Vietnam War Memorial dedication and a recent new mold debacle.
Exciting stuff. Then we'll talk to Andrew Dalton, the president of College Democrats, to debrief the 2018 midterm elections and the club's plans moving forward. Stay with us. Let's dive into the news segment. Gari, tell us about the college's new Vietnam Memorial.
Yeah, so we have a new, like, placard outside of the new part of the College Union building, right by the patio, outside of Bullitt. And it has all of the names of the Gettysburg alums who passed away in the Vietnam War. There was a wreath. I don't think the wreath is going to stay.
Yeah, I think the wreath is not a permanent part of it.
Yeah, but, you know, it's black and it has the American flag on top of it. It's really pretty. And, you know, they had a service for, like, indoctrinating it into Gettysburg's community over last weekend. We're recording this on Sunday, November
18th,
so it was last weekend. In which a few people spoke, including President Riggs, just about the people who had gone to Gettysburg College and also had fought in the war and lost their lives, as well as Susan Colstock Hill and Colonel Edward G. Southworth talked and spoke about these men. And it was a very solemn and just hopeful celebration of life, I guess is the way I would call it.
Yeah, and you can read more about the 14 individuals who were honored in an excellent feature that Lizzie Hobbs, a staff writer for the Gettysburgian, did, entitled "Our Vietnam Veterans, a Blue Angel, an Objector, and a Medal of Honor Recipient." You can also, in Musselman Library right now, see a photo collection from one of those veterans, Stephen Henry Warner. And so the college, as part of the ceremony, also had a Black Hawk helicopter on campus. It was kind of funny to see that as this helicopter was leaving campus, I was at the Gettysburg football game that was happening at that time, and the helicopter did a flyover of the stadium, and all of the heads of fans looked up at the helicopter instead of down at the football game. And it's safe to say that the helicopter was more entertaining than the football game. The football team, well, lost. They dropped the Lincoln Trophy to Franklin and Marshall, 34-10 in the season finale, a fairly disappointing end. I guess you, I would say it's safe to say, to Kevin Burke's first season as head coach. Burke replacing Barry Streeter after 42 years of his affiliation with the program. There were a lot of high hopes for the season, and it didn't go so well.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we won one game?
1-9, I believe, is the final record for the team. They won against Juniata at a time when both teams entering were 0-5. So someone had to win. You know, it'll be interesting to see how the program goes from here. Kevin Burke is a relentlessly positive individual, particularly on his Twitter page. You would not know by following his Twitter page that the team is 1-9. But, you know, I think that they will continue to endeavor to improve. Certainly there's nowhere to go but up. So we'll have to see how that goes moving forward. Of course, interestingly enough, when the football team defeated Juniata, Kevin Burke was formerly the head coach at Juniata. So the first win of his career, and to date the only win of his career at Gettysburg, was over his former team. What else is going on around Gettysburg College?
Well, Student Senate is...
Student Senate, our dear friends.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Well, most recently...
You know, last time on this podcast, we talked about having a direct line to Student Senate President Nick Arbaugh, like Fox and Friends has a direct line to President Trump.
He didn't like it very much.
Well, I spoke to Nick Arbaugh, and he thought it was pretty funny. So, hey again, Nick. Happy to have you on the line today. Let's talk about Student Senate.
Yeah, so during the student concerns section of last Monday's Student Senate meeting, Abby Hauer, parliamentarian, class of 2021, spoke. She's a member of Alpha Phi Omega, APO, which is the co-ed
philanthropic. Service fraternity.
Yeah, service fraternity on campus. And they have their chapter room in the basement of Christ Chapel. And Abby spoke about the mold that had taken place in their chapter room that had taken place over the summer. I guess the college, Hauer at least, suggests that the college did not carry out any checks over the summer, and their materials, including a lot of their furniture, I believe they said they had like 10 to 12 couches in there. I don't know how that all fit, but they had a lot of couches, and they also have all of their memorabilia, and all of that was lost and thrown out. And they were given some furniture as a replacement from Naus.
Naus is the college's off-site storage facility that just attracts random crap that people don't want anymore.
We also keep all of, like, theater props and costumes in there.
Like I said, random crap that no one wants anymore.
Yeah, and they, from what I've heard from Abby in the Student Senate meeting and a few other members of APO, just, like, that I'm friends with, it's not even close to what all they had in there. And she brought it up to Student Senate, and I believe they want to discuss with facilities a better way to rectify the issue.
Yeah, and I mean, this comes back to sort of the saga that happened last spring when various residential facilities were infested with mold. In that context, the college decided to give $250 to each affected student. What's interesting is that, you know, the argument the college has made is that they owe people nothing because in a residential context, mold is something that would be not the responsibility of the landlord in a landlord-tenant situation, that it would fall to renter's insurance or something like that. Or homeowner's insurance, but in the rental context, renter's insurance to pay for damaged items. What the college doesn't talk about in that context is that the college is not in a landlord-tenant relationship. The college does not lease these facilities to students and to student groups. There's a license, but it's not a lease. The college students do not enjoy landlord-tenant protections under the Fair Housing Act or anything of the sort in most cases. And if they did, the college would have to conduct its business significantly differently than it does. For example, you know, in a landlord-tenant situation, tenants have recourse if they're being moved and they feel that they're being moved unfairly. The college, however, has license to move anyone at any time they want as part of the residential consolidation policy. And, you know, there are certain rights in a landlord-tenant situation that a tenant cannot sign away. So the college wants to have this both ways, that, you know, in the case of mold, it's a landlord-tenant situation, and so it's incumbent upon you to have renter's insurance to cover your lost belongings. But, oh, by the way, you're not getting tenant landlord-tenant protections if we decide tomorrow that we want to move someone into your room. Tough luck. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that there's a clear double standard there that the college seems inclined to pass over. And, you know, that's, I suppose, their prerogative to do because there's no real remedy for students. But to the extent that Student Senate and other organizations have capacity to raise a collective voice, I think that there's an opportunity, certainly, to potentially have something to the effect of a student's bill of rights, for lack of a better term, with respect to residential and facilities concerns. Certainly, I think that there's a lot of frustration around what has transpired over the past several months. And I don't think these problems are going to go away. The college, as we've noted many times, has a lot of older buildings on this campus. And, you know, in the case of the chapel, which is where this APO room that had the mold issue was, like, it's understandable that in the basement of an old building, when it's wet, there's going to be some mold, and this was a wet summer. What is not understandable is why, you know, this wasn't addressed when it happened as opposed to when everyone else showed up. If the college knows that this building is old and that it was wet and that it's in the basement. So, you know, anyone with if it's an old building and it's wet and, you know, in the basement, I think most people, particularly, I would hope, the people the college is hiring to manage the college's facilities could foresee that there might be mold there. And the fact that they didn't seem to recognize that, I think, has caused some understandable frustration among members of APO. All right, off the soapbox.
Thank you. I will say that I do think that for especially student senate members, especially ones that were here last year, specifically last semester, I think it is really discouraging to hear more issues with mold after Hansen and after everything that happened with Hansen. I think we were all under the impression that because of Hansen and because of how bad it got last year, especially with communication, I think a lot of us were hoping that that would not get to that again. And I think that we were also hoping that it wouldn't get to that for the college's sake. You know, it's not, yes, it is a health issue. And yes, like there's all these things like we can say about like students don't want this to happen. But for the college's sake, I don't understand why you would want to have more of these issues because it's not a great PR, you know, thing to have. Every single headline of the Gettysburg Journal on the front page being about mold every single time. It was not great. And I also don't think that it's great to see situations where we're not, where students aren't getting what they want out of a college and it's just this constant back and forth. And if something as easy as doing the routine checks properly and thoroughly and communicating properly could resolve this issue, like, I don't think students, maybe some students are, but I'm not under the impression that mold's not going to happen. I think that something as easy as just communicating in a timely fashion would just help the college as well. No one's asking them to change the way science works. I think they're just asking them to just change the way that their communication works, even if it's as easy as sending out an email. I don't understand why that's not possible in the 21st century.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the college, and in fact that the college, I'm sure, does believe it's responded appropriately, but ultimately the burden of communication is on the communicator. And certainly that's something that would be imbued within the liberal arts philosophy of a college that seeks to foster effective communication skills. And the irony that the college does not seem to be practicing what it preaches in that regard, insofar as students don't feel like their concerns have been heard, is emblematic of the fact that there's a problem here. And, you know, to the idea that the college doesn't really, you know, that students have no immediate recourse. Yeah, that's true. But I think we just came off a $150 million campaign, and who are the big donors to that? Alumni. So if students, there's that quote that people don't remember what you did for them, but they remember how you made them feel. And if students feel that the college doesn't care what, you know, when they have grievances about health, safety, and just general comfort levels on campus, I would imagine that perhaps the next generation of John Jagers would be less inclined to write large checks towards campus projects. I don't like to have to frame things in those terms, but frankly, I think there's a population that rightly believes that the college sees things in those terms. And so here we are.
Speaking of just students and concerns, I guess. Student Senate went through a few changes.
That was a nice segue.
Thank you very much. I tried very hard.
Speaking of students.
Listen, I was trying to get you off your soapbox. It didn't go that great.
Yeah, I think that was the first big soapbox moment we've had in the 2018 fall season of On Target with me.
Student Senate last...
For another good soapbox, refer to the April Fool's episode of last year. All right, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Actually, that's not true. I did mean to interrupt. But anyway, carry on.
Sometimes I wonder what this podcast would be like if I wasn't here, and I feel like it would be exactly the same. So anyway, two Student Senate meetings ago, we went through some announcements and an election process in regards to just different leadership within Student Senate. So Larissa Horodisky, class of 2021, who is the current club's liaison chair, will be transferring next semester. And we knew about this for a few weeks now, and we went through some applications for a new club's liaison, and elections happened 2 weeks ago. Four candidates came up for a forum, two of which were present and two of which were abroad and submitted videos. Courtney Chalua of Class of 22 and Grace Wenzel, Class of 21, who is also the committee chair for...
PRIT!
Thanks, Ben.
Public Relations and Information Technology, yeah. Or PRIT, as apparently yeah. Some people want to call them. It's almost as good a nickname as Scoggle.
We don't have to talk about Scoggle. We're not talking about Scoggle right now. And two video submissions, one from Jackie Crowley, Class of 20, who, it should be noted, was the club's liaison chair in the previous year, and Ethan Murphy, also Class of 2020. However, I believe Ethan had never been a senator of note. So Courtney and Grace both sat for a forum that was led by Alexis Seacrest of the Gettysburg News Network, answered a few questions. Grace has revolved, I guess, more around the fact that she is heavily involved with College Democrats, and it was interesting. I found it interesting that Alexa thought it was of note that maybe people would have an issue with someone who was very left-leaning being on the executive board, while we also have Haley Gluhanich of College Republicans and Nick Arbaugh of Young Americans of Freedom, and very proudly so, both of them. And that was
Marissa Beland is a member of College Democrats. Yeah. I think that the people that are attracted to student senate are also generally attracted to other forms of politics.
Yeah. And Courtney's, I think, revolved a little bit more on the fact that she is a freshman, first year, sorry. and in the end, senators and affinity group leaders all voted by secret ballot, and Grace Wenzel, the class of 21, will be the club's liaison in the spring semester. She will also hold her senator position as a, I believe she's a, I think she's just a senator for the grade for the class of 2021, and she's the committee chair of PRIT. Also, Hannah Dalzell will be taking over as the new diversity committee chair. So far, what I've heard from the conversation groups on campus that seem to have more issues with Joshua Gonzalez is that while they don't really know how heavily involved Hannah is with all the conversation groups, I believe she is pretty involved with ASA, and she was also the MC last year for Berkburst.
She's the vice president of the Asian Student Association.
Yeah. She, you know, she's been visiting events, apparently, but people have been interested just in how she's going to be taking over. People have said that people in those conversation groups have said that they think she was a more appropriate choice than Gonzalez. So we'll see how that pans out. And now I think applications are being sent in for a co-chair for PRIT, focusing specifically on PR. As well as applications for Scoggle coming down the pike.
Yeah, it seems like Scoggle's having a little trouble getting off the ground, mm-hmm. and we'll have to follow up on that particular issue in the coming days. But, you know, this committee was announced almost a month ago, and we're still soliciting applications, so you have to wonder kind of what the reaction within the Greek community and also within the non-Greek community is to that. That's going to wrap up our news segment. We'll be right back with the Bullet Report and then our interview with Andrew Dalton. Stay with us. Now it's time for the Bullet Report. It's been an exciting 2 weeks in Gettysburg College sports action as winter sports season is underway. On November the 3rd, the women's swimming team defeated Washington College 156-90. The men's swimming team defeated Washington College 154-105. The women's basketball team lost an exhibition to the University of Maryland, Baltimore County 65-51. The women's cross country team finished 22-47 at the NCAA Mideast Regional. The men's wrestling team finished 1st-6 at the Gettysburg Invitational. The men's cross country team finished 21st-52 at the NCAA Mideast Regional. The football team lost its season finale 34-10 to Franklin and Marshall. The men's swimming team defeated Susquehanna 153-103. The men's swimming team defeated Messiah 161-92. The women's swimming team defeated Susquehanna 161-99 and Messiah 147-113. All of that happened on November the 10th. The men's basketball team lost 86-71 to Penn State Harrisburg. The men's basketball team also lost 84-80 to Lebanon Valley on November 11th. The women's basketball team lost to Messiah 74-69. The men's basketball team lost to York 89-71. Those games were both on the 13th. On the 14th, the men's swimming team defeated McDaniel 52-32. The women's swimming team defeated McDaniel 54-22. The men's basketball team on the 16th defeated Ithaca 92-84. The men's basketball team defeated Albright and then Randolph-Macon 82-69. The women's swimming team lost to Ursinus 141-121. On the 17th, the men's swimming team defeated Ursinus 141-121. The men's basketball team lost in the Gettysburg Invitational tip-off finale to Randolph-Macon 88-67. The women's basketball team defeated Juniata 73-66. The men's wrestling team defeated Scranton 25-18. The women's basketball team defeated Lebanon Valley 76-61. The men's wrestling team defeated Rowan College of Gloucester County 27-18. And the men's wrestling team defeated Penn State Mont Alto 46-9. Also, earlier today, on Sunday. Thus endeth the Bullet Report. We'll be right back with Andrew Dalton. And we're thrilled to be joined today by Andrew Dalton, the president of College Democrats. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start, for those who may be living under a rock, an election occurred recently, and Andrew, as president of College Democrats, you were heavily involved in that. Why don't we start with your top-level reaction to what happened on Election Day?
Sure. We were extremely pleased with the results. You know, we expected that Democrats would win back the House of Representatives. We're thrilled to see it's almost by 40 seats. The net gain is about 40, maybe 38, 39 at the moment. Just really fantastic to see that. We expected to see very close Senate races, and that's what happened nationally. We lost some, we gained some. But here on campus, I was most encouraged by the tremendous turnout that we saw on Election Day. Young people voting is really, I think, one of the core messages that you can take away from this election, voting in levels that you've really never seen before in a midterm year, and that's what we had on campus.
Mm-hmm. And so do you want to talk a little bit about those numbers? I know that the College Democrats were heavily involved ahead of the election in registering new voters and, you know, turning out those voters once they'd been registered.
Right. Yeah. So we registered about 300 new people in preparation for the election. We had so many great volunteers who sat in the Cub every day. And we had people around campus in front of Servo, people registering their friends, people in the library. So, you know, that's always just so important, you know, in preparation for an election to make sure we can get as many people on the books as possible. And that's what we did. We really encouraged people to register here because Pennsylvania has been such a close state in recent elections. And then on Election Day, you know, in the week before Election Day, we spent a lot of time creating a voter guide, getting it out to over 400 students. We knocked over 400 doors. On Election Day, we're in the Cub, and we had a team of about 20 people working to contact those who were registered here to make sure we could get as many people out as possible. And that's what happened. So we were really fortunate.
Yeah, and you had said on Election Day that some 78% of campus voters turned out,
right, yeah,
90% of Democrats.
Yeah, right. About 77% overall of the campus in terms of people registered here voted, which is just much higher. You know, we expected maybe 50-60%. In an off-year election, you know, I had talked to some of the local candidates in the local party, and you know, they said, you think you can get half of the people to vote? And we thought, you know, that's a reasonable goal. I think we can do it. And we did. I mean, we were surprised. It wasn't just us. I mean, a lot of other organizations were pushing voting this year, but 77% overall, 90% of Democrats voted. I think that had a lot to do with what we did. 75% of independents and about 50% of Republicans. So, you know, obviously our emphasis was to get the Democrats and the independents out. And we had a lot of people personally contacting friends of theirs that were on the voter rolls. And I think that interaction and the personal interaction between people, that was really what made it happen in the end. Because people, you know, are much more likely, I think, to come out and vote when a friend of theirs says, hey, have you voted yet? Or, hey, are you going to come out to Cub? It's very easy. It takes just a minute. Do it. And, you know, at times the lines were so long. We were just the whole day we were just excited and thrilled by people's the turnout and the reaction mm-hmm. that we were seeing. So,
yeah. And I know that you also, in addition to, you know, working up on the top of the ballot races with some of the in Pennsylvania specifically. Bob Casey was reelected to the Senate, and Tom Wolf was reelected governor. But I know you also worked on a down ballot race with Marty Qualley. What did you make of the fact that he ran behind Casey and Wolf a little bit in Adams County, despite, you know, it being a local race and him being a face in the community? And just what are your thoughts on that particular race?
Right. Yeah, we were a little bit surprised by that. But, you know, in local elections, everybody knows everybody. So everybody knows Dan Mao. Everybody knows Marty Qualley. But Dan Mao's been around for so much longer in terms of, you know, in statewide office. So, you know, I was discouraged by that. But if you look at the raw numbers, the straight party voting, especially for Republicans, was as high as, you know, 80%. So to overcome the fact that people are just coming in and voting for a party, not candidates, really made a difference there. You know, he's a great candidate. Marty Qualley, really, we were thrilled to work for him. It was great experience for a lot of our younger students to be able to actually get out and knock doors for the first time, and to actually meet and work with a candidate directly, which is something, you know, I think a lot of people don't get that experience so early. And, you know, we were disappointed. You know, Dan Mowell, his record just is really... is poor in Harrisburg. He doesn't have a record of actually getting things done and passing real legislation and working across the aisle. And we were hoping that people locally would recognize that and see that, you know, maybe electing a moderate Democrat who's very much down the middle would be good for Adams County, but that just didn't happen. And although he did cut the margin of loss from 2016 in that race about in half, so he lost by about half as much as the last Democrat. So he did gain some ground, but we were hoping for a little more there, but we were well aware of how much of an uphill battle that was.
Right. But overall, it's fair to say that you were pleased with the turnout and the election day results.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially statewide. You know, Scott Wagner, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, he ran very similar to Trump. You know, he ran with Trump's tactics. He ran with Trump's, you know, vulgar, you know, attacks. He at one point said he wanted to stomp all over the face of his opponent. I mean, when you see stuff like that, I mean, I personally was worried. I mean, because Pennsylvania voters came out and voted for that message in 2016. I mean, they voted for that type of politics. But, you know, this year, to see such a strong reaction against that statewide, you know, losing by like 17 points really says something, I think, about the turning of the tide here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Is it your sense that different voters came out to vote in 2018 than in 2016, or that minds were changed and the same people voted just in an opposite way?
That's a very good question. So I looked at just Adams County results, and you know, the Democrats, we actually... more people voted this year for Democrats than they did in 2016. It wasn't by a lot. The real difference was that the Trump voters did not come out. In 2016, there were about 5,000 voters that just came out of the woodwork to vote for Trump in Adams County. There were people who had not voted in previous elections. Mitt Romney didn't have those voters in 2012. But that 5,000, you know, is critical to Trump winning the state of Pennsylvania in 2016, because that 5,000 was duplicated everywhere across the state in all these rural counties. So when all those people came out and voted, it was enough to just barely put Trump over. And that did not happen this year. So I think it was a combination of maybe not switching over to the Democrats, and maybe there was some of that. But I think a lot of Republicans just stayed home this year because they were disenfranchised by the candidates that were running. But if you look at one specific area, I think one of the most interesting takeaways from this entire election in Pennsylvania is Erie County. Democrats have consistently won Erie County in presidential elections. Obama carried it by a significant margin both times. But Clinton lost Erie County in 2016. And there are a lot of votes up there in northwestern PA. And Trump actually won Erie County, which was a huge upset statewide. And that was enough to actually really kind of make his victory margin, those votes. And this year, Tom Wolf won Erie County by a huge margin. So really, just to see that flip back towards the Democrats, it might signal that working class PA voters are kind of fed up with Trump and his message.
And what were you seeing on campus? Like, I know that you and Christina Noto, well, College Democrats and Christina Noto, but specifically you and Christina, co-hosted the Go Vote initiative the night before election. Were you seeing people there that you kind of expected to come? Did you feel like you saw a different audience that you normally see at political events?
Right. That's a great question. We saw a lot of regular people, but we also did see a lot of people who don't show up to political events. I think a lot of that was because we had like six or seven co-sponsors on campus. And I think really, you know, in 2016, the political clubs were invested in the election, but this year I think a lot of other clubs were invested in the election too. GECO, Black Student Union, Latin American Student Association, like these groups, you know, they I think from what I heard, at least from people involved, they really saw this election as more than just political, as a real, you know, a real time for young people, especially to come out and say, this is not the America that we grew up in. Like, this is not normal. And we are going to reject these politicians that carried Trump's message. Mm-hmm. And we saw that. And so I think there was great energy that night. We had like 80 people there, which was wonderful. But to go out the night before the election and see, you know, a lot of people there who might not necessarily show up in a you know, previous year, you know, to actually really pay attention this year is great.
Since 2016 and since that election, have you seen a change in the way we view politics on Gettysburg's campus?
That's a really good question, too. Yes, I think so. When we were registering voters in 2016, it was about even, male, female. This year, it wasn't. Almost 60% of the voters this year were women. So it was 60-40. You know, I think, and when I first saw the numbers, when we got our numbers back from the courthouse, when we looked at all the people we had recently registered, it was overwhelmingly female, especially Democrats. And if you look at the turnout on Election Day, too, among Democrats, the female turnout was 92%. The male was 87%. So over 9 out of 10 female Democrats on campus came out to vote. And for Republicans, though, the female turnout was 47%. It was the lowest of any demographic group for turnout on campus was female Republicans. So not only have we seen a shift, I think, you know, in terms of excitement and women registering to vote, either as independent or Democrat, but I think the whole culture around politics is really changing right now. And you can see that nationally with we're sending the most women to Congress ever before this year. And I think, you know, women are really upset with this president, and women are upset with the Republican Party and where it's headed. And I think there are a lot of good Republicans out there who are standing up and saying, no, this is not who we are, but it would be nice to see more of that. And I think until that happens, women are going to be voting Democrat in droves like we saw this year.
Yeah.
Do you get the sense that there's sort of an enthusiasm gap there between Democrats and Republicans, at least in this election on this campus? You had you know, in the article that we published after the election, you had talked extensively about the college Democrats voter turnout efforts and college Republicans voter turnout efforts were, I don't want to say non-existent, but at least very geared towards the members of their existing club and not really out reaching out to new voters. Do you think that the enthusiasm gap there is broader than just the mobilization levels of the clubs, or what do you kind of make of that?
Right. The quote in the article that really struck me was that the Republicans are on campus are focusing on internal work. And I just can't imagine in an election year why anyone would be focused internally. I mean, an election is about external work. It's about getting people who wouldn't necessarily vote to vote. You know, I think it's hard for them on a college campus, especially now, because, you know, I think within their, and I don't want to speak for them, but from what I've heard, you know, the conservative clubs on campus are very torn. You know, we have a president who's extremely unpopular among young people. And, you know, I think I really respect Republicans who are Republican because of, you know, fiscal conservatism. They're Republican because, you know, they believe in freedom and equality abroad and America standing up as, you know, a nation to be respected, to be revered, you know, internationally. But then there's this Republican Party that's, you know, nationalistic and, you know, Trumpian, and I think the Republicans on campus are probably very torn. I think some of them are very uncomfortable with where the current National Republican Party is. So I think it's hard for them to actually come together at all, really, right now. Because the Republican Party, you know, I don't know how to define the Republican Party right now. Is it Donald Trump? You know, is it John McCain? You know, and until they figure that out for themselves, I would encourage every member of the College Republicans to really think about what side of history they want to be on. You know, do they want to support this president and his policies? Because I don't think in 10, 15, 20 years, that's going to be in the mainstream anymore. And I think that they will have regretted their support for him. So, you know, in this election, yeah, the enthusiasm was on our side. In 2016, they didn't really organize either. So, You know, I think it's a combination of being in a hostile environment, I think a college campus, and maybe it shouldn't be so hostile. And I'd encourage people on the left to treat everyone with respect, regardless of where they fall on the spectrum. But, you know, this year and 2016 both, you know, on our campus at least, the enthusiasm's been on our side.
I think we also see on campus a bit of, like, we talk, you kind of mentioned this about just, like, the way that the left and the right kind of discuss things, and in situations like debates on campus, like the EI debate, people do talk a lot about the idea that the right has kind of been silenced on this campus and on college campuses across the nation, especially after the 2016 elections. You know, it's a lot of shutdowns of, like, defining something that someone said as racist or xenophobic or whatever before opening up a conversation. Have you seen a lot of that on campus lately?
You know, I do see some of it, and it concerns me. I'm a huge proponent of free speech, and I don't speak for every member of College Democrats when I say this, but but I think shutting down speakers that we don't agree with, you know, in terms of coming to visiting campus or otherwise, I don't think that's a winning strategy for us. I think, you know, ugliness has to be fought out in the open, and if you silence people who you don't agree with, you know, that is not the way to advance debate and to really, you know, take on these ideas and actually challenge them. Because I think you win by challenging the ideas and presenting a better alternative. And if Democrats don't do that, they're not going to win. So, you know, in terms of on campus, I think it's good to encourage debate. And I consistently encourage my friends who are liberal to hear the conservative perspective on issues when we're talking about policy. But where I would draw the line is when you talk about basic human decency and treating others with respect, which this president has had a really hard time with, that's where I would draw the line. We're not going to debate that. We're not going to debate whether people are welcome here on campus because of where they were born or what their status is in terms of immigration. That's not acceptable. And I think a lot of Republicans agree with that, that that's not acceptable, especially young Republicans. So if we're talking about policy, we should welcome that kind of debate. But when we're talking about Trump's, and not just Trump, but, you know, some of the more vulgar and offensive, you know, attacks that are being made, you know, based on people's core identities, that's not something that I tolerate. And I don't think there's any room for debate there.
Kind of to that point you just raised, though, about drawing a line between debates on policy and debates on other things, how do you approach that in an environment where I think it's safe to say that this president and many who support him have kind of intertwined those two things such that their policy perspective on, say, immigration is rooted in kind of a core personal, maybe not personal, but an attack on a cultural identity. And so, you know, you say that you don't want to shut down policy debates, but when people, you know, to the dignity point you raised, would find that their policy is not dignified, how do you kind of separate those
two
things?
It's so hard to separate now. I think the biggest problem here is that a lot of that is driven by the politics of fear. And Republicans have successfully used, you know, fear to drive a lot of their policy initiatives. You know, if in terms of immigration, you know, they scare people, and then, you know, they get this bandwagon, you know, support from their base. And to try to separate that can be very difficult. But I think at the core of it, most people, especially young people, I think we agree on a lot more than we disagree on. I think that in terms of immigration, I think a lot of the Republicans I know here on campus, they don't have this hardline approach that Trump has toward immigration. They don't believe that we should be mass deporting people. They don't believe we should be getting rid of people's DACA status and not protecting those individuals. So I think it's just very hard right now for Republicans to come out and say, no, I don't agree with that. You know, maybe I agree with, you know, promoting a system of legal immigration and improving that system, but I don't agree with the way this president is taking people and their lives and their reputations and using them as bait for a group of supporters in order to have electoral success, which is what's going on. So it's so hard really to answer. It's hard to answer your question because right now it is so hard to have a policy debate with someone who subscribes to that type of politics where it's not about the issue. It's about people that are different from you that you're afraid of, perhaps. And to separate that out requires people kind of coming out of their bubbles and talking to people who are different and who have gone through some of these things. You know, when you talk to someone who is an undocumented immigrant, and you come away from that conversation, I think almost everyone would come away from that conversation having sympathy for that person, understanding that they have a very difficult life, that they have challenges that we can't possibly understand. But when you don't do that, when you're unwilling to come into an environment where you're challenged and you have to talk to those people, it's very easy to hold these prejudices. And so it makes debate really difficult.
Yeah, and kind of, I guess, two follow-ups to that. One is to that point you just raised about talking to people who have different lived experiences. I think that there's a critique of the left that, you know, particularly when it comes to those who may have been adversely affected by some of globalization's effects, that, you know, may be more naturally inclined towards some of the more pro-protectionist trade views and get kind of caught up in the rhetoric of bringing the jobs roaring back, which can get intertwined with that immigration narrative. How do you think the left, or do you think the left, needs to do a better job of kind of understanding those stories?
Right. Yeah. We have to get out into the rural areas of this country and actually start talking to people again. You know, Bill Clinton, despite all of his faults, he did that really well. He went out into areas and he talked to people who were suffering from these issues. And they're legitimate issues. I think, you know, in terms of trade, there's no easy solution. There's no one way or the other. It's so easy. You know, if you listen to Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, you know, it's 100% this. And we can't do any of that. We have to, you know, protect our workers. We can't be engaged in some of these trade agreements abroad that are negatively impacting our workforce. But it's not that simple. And politicians want to oversimplify this issue. And it's really at the expense of the very people, you know, who are supporting Donald Trump to some extent, because, you know, he hasn't shown any real empathy or compassion in terms of policy initiatives for the people that have voted for him. I mean, people are suffering under these trade deals, especially farmers. The tariffs are negatively impacting them. So if you look at this Republican policy that's going on right now, it's kind of detached from what has been promised to these people. And if we send politicians out, you know, who understand these issues, like, for instance, Joe Biden, I think is very effective. And you talk to these people and say, look, we need to focus on, you know, retraining for different jobs. The workforce is changing. We can't do anything about that. What we can do is provide programs that help and assist as we, you know, transition into a new, you know, economic order. But, you know, I think really the answer to your question is that Democrats need to get out into these areas and talk to people who wouldn't necessarily vote for them. They need to not be afraid to talk to white rural Americans. And, you know, when Hillary Clinton campaigned across Pennsylvania, you know, I really admire Hillary Clinton and I worked hard for her campaign. And I don't think this was necessarily her fault or her decision, but you didn't see her in rural areas of the state. She did not come to Adams County. She didn't send any surrogates here. I've grown up in this area. This was the first presidential election where there were no Democratic surrogates sent here. None. Not a single one. There were no campaign events in Adams County for Democrats. And that was true in rural counties all across the state. So when you allow that to happen, people do perceive that the Democratic Party has forgotten about them, has left them behind, you know, is not worried about their interests. And until we fix that, you know, we need to be sending people out. Like, for instance, Bob Casey and Tom Wolf are on a bus tour around the state. You know, that's the way we win back these areas. And we actually talk to people and listen to their concerns. So I agree with you. Democrats can do a better job of talking to people who are, mm-hmm. who are, you know, not city, you know, city liberals as people perceive them to be.
Coastal elites.
Right. Yeah.
And then the second follow-up, you've mentioned a few times knowing Republicans on campus who are not enchanted by the sort of Trump agenda. How do you think, you know, either as a club or more broadly, that the campus political climate can do a better job to give them, and I'm going to use a term that's perhaps charged, a safe space,
right,
to kind of flesh out those ideas in a more nuanced way? Because, you know, in an Eisenhower Institute policy debate, you know, people are representing the political organizations on campus. And I've talked to some of these folks that you're mentioning as well, and they say that they feel like as college Republicans, you have to kind of defend the party line, so
right.
to say.
Yeah.
So how do you kind of find that nuance in debate?
Well, it's difficult. I think, you know, my unfiltered opinion is that they should be voting for Democrats until this problem is solved. They should be voting for people who are more in line with, you know, the traditional, you know, Republican agenda of the last 20, 30 years. And right now that's Democrats. There are a lot of great moderate Democrats running that better represent Republican values than the Republicans do. But I think that's hard for some people. And, you know, I said at our first College Democrats meeting, if you are a Republican and you are disgruntled by what's going on, what's happening to your party, you're welcome here too. Like, so I very much encourage people who are middle of the road, moderate, to come listen at College Democrats meetings and, you know, engage with us in debate, because even conservative ideas right now, it is very good for Democrats to be hearing those ideas and listening. And I don't agree with 90% of what some of my Republican friends think, but I want to hear what they have to say. And I think it's good for Democrats and it's good for liberals to hear them out. And as long as they're willing to admit that right now their party is, you know, in shambles, I think is safe to say, at least most of them feel that way. So it's very difficult, but I think they have to do it. I don't think it should be on anybody else. Like, I'd like to see Republicans come out and say, this is not who we are. This is not our party. We can retake our party. We can stand for fiscal conservatism. We can stand for American foreign policy. You know, we can do those things, and we can distance ourselves from this president, and we can chart a new path. And I think that young people have to be doing that. Republicans on college campuses need to be saying, nope, this is not the Republican Party running the show right now. That's not it. It's not who we are, and we're not gonna partake in this. We're gonna take our party back. And I would encourage that to happen.
Now we're seeing, I think, more conversations, especially within Student Senate, about what it's like to have this issue of, like, when is something political and when is something just a thing. And I know a lot of people talk about the fact that Nick Arbaugh, who is president of Young Americans for Freedom, is also the president of Student Senate. And Grace Wentzel was just recently elected to be club's liaison for next semester. For you, do you think Student Senate is politically charged one way or another?
I don't regularly attend their meetings, so I can't speak too much to that. Yeah. I haven't seen anything that concerns me at all with the way that Student Senate's been operating so far this year. We have received very fair treatment from them in our various endeavors this year in bringing in speakers and such. So I can't really speak to that. You know, I think it's good that there's diversity of opinion on Student Senate in the executive board politically. I think it would be poor for the college if there wasn't diversity of opinion there.
And sort of the last question, where do you, in the aftermath of this election, where do you kind of turn your attention as college Democrats from here? And of course, you know, anytime any unaffiliated with a campaign Democrat comes on any kind of talk show, they get asked, who's your favorite 2020 candidate? So right, I wouldn't want to let you off without sure, at least giving you this chance to weigh in on that. But more broadly, where do you kind of turn your attention from here?
So we are kind of in a lull right now, given that we threw everything we had at the election. But we're excited to get back to business, and we have some really cool speakers that we're kind of talking to right now. I can't say any names because one of them could be a really great event. It's just that we have to get confirmation first. But we're going to probably bring in the former Maryland Secretary of State to talk about politics in Maryland. We have a couple other speakers that we're going for. And, you know, we'll probably be attending the statewide College Democrats convention, which is always fun. But, you know, for the most part, I think, you know, we're going to focus on still registering voters, even though the election's over. We do that all year. It's a nonpartisan. And we're going to focus on, you know, trying to keep people engaged and interested and paying attention to what's going on, because I expect in the next 3 or 4 months, we'll be seeing some very important things in Washington, including the results of the long-anticipated Mueller investigation. So we'll see how that turns out. That could create kind of a conundrum for us, I think, because how bad is it? And we don't. No one knows how bad it is. If it's really bad, you know, is it bad enough that the House of Representatives has the responsibility to pursue impeachment of this president? I mean, that's kind of getting ahead of things, but that could be a question that we're faced with, and we could see a lot of justifiable anger on campus about whatever the results of that might might be. So that could be something that comes up as a surprise. Mm-hmm. As for the 2020 candidate, there are a lot of people. I think everyone we think is going to run is going to run. I anticipate it'll be a very crowded field.
76 candidates on the stage for the
It's
first
hard
debate.
To say. I mean, you know, Trump, I think, is a vulnerable president. And I think his electability is very much in question right now, especially with the results we may see of this investigation. So I'm not sure. I would like to see I have mixed feelings because I'd like to see someone young and new and fresh to bring some new energy to the Democratic Party. But I also have extreme respect for people like Joe Biden. And if he runs, I think it would be an asset to the system, no matter what the outcome would be, to have someone who's so experienced and who's so good at talking to people and understanding people. So we'll see.
Very diplomatic answer. Andrew Dalton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank Andrew Dalton for being our featured guest today.
We would also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their ongoing support in this project. Be sure to subscribe to On Target on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, senior music major in the Sunderman Conservatory of Music. Be sure to join us next week. Until then, happy Thanksgiving.